You can't find a California condor living in the wild along the north coast of California, but the big birds lived there once and could live there again. Condors were once part of the North Coast ecosystem and a big part of the culture of the Yurok tribe, so it should come as no surprise that the Yurok are deeply involved in an effort to reintroduce condors in the region. It is not a sure thing just yet, but the work continues, and now there are legal agreements setting out a process for the potential return of the condors. Two guests join us. Chris West is the senior wildlife biologist on this program, directing the condor program for the tribe. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
Tiana Williams is with us as well. She's a wildlife technician at a Yurok tribal member. Tiana, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Chris, start first of all with how long the tribe has been working to bring condors back to the North Coast. How did the idea first surface?
Well, actually, Tiana may be better to bring that around. She's actually been on the project for longer than I have. Tiana, do you want to take that?
Sure. The project has actually been going on longer than I've been here. It started in a planning process, I think, around 2003. There had been a committee at that time called the Tribal Park Task Force, which was made up of tribal elders, which were discussing what were species that were critically important for the Yurok tribe to reintroduce or otherwise improve their populations. The top two were salmon and sturgeon, which would be unsurprising, but then the third that came up, and which hadn't had any previous management by the tribe, was the California condor. And then it followed a series of years trying to get funding to get this reintroduction feasibility process started. And in 2008, we received funding from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to actually get started looking at issues that would be relevant to condor reintroduction in Yurok ancestral territory. And so, we've been going since.
So there's really a long process, it sounds like, of just sort of figuring out what has to happen before even anything can happen in a real-world sense.
Right.
Got it. So can you give us an idea, Tiana, of the importance of California condors to Yurok tribal heritage?
Well, the California condor is very integral to Yurok culture and spirituality. They feature heavily in our world renewal ceremonies, in the jump dance and the white deerskin dance, which are considered to be the highest of our ceremonies. We use their regalia, and there's a special song that we sing that is specifically for these world renewal ceremonies. Makes sense if you consider that a condor is kind of the ultimate renewer. It's taking a dead thing and it's making life out of it. They're considered to be a very powerful creature and one that's to be respected. They've one of the oldest creatures that the creator put on the earth. They fly the highest, so they're the ones that it makes sense that they take our prayers to the creator. So they haven't been here for over 100 years, and it's been very impactful to not only the Yurok tribe but to a lot of the surrounding tribes as well, who hold similar sacredness for the condor.
That's an interesting cultural idea, though. The condors, because they fly higher, deliver the messages to the creator.
Yeah.
Chris West, give us the biological end of things. What condors are all about, what they do, how big they are, and how long it's been since they've been around the North Coast on a regular basis.
Well, condors are the largest land bird in North America, so they have a wingspan of about 9.5 feet. They typically weigh between about 18 and 23 pounds, so they're quite large, and they're impressive when you see them soaring with that large wingspan. They really require a lot of lift to keep up in the air, to keep all that weight up. So they rely quite heavily on very topographic areas as far as hilly, kind of mountainous terrain, to be able to get the winds required for soaring. So they typically stay close to mountain ranges. And as was mentioned earlier, they haven't been in this area for over 100 years. The last condors that were collected from the Pacific Northwest, the condors did extend all the way up into British Columbia at one point in time. But the last ones that were collected from the Neyland area of Humboldt County. The last condor was believed to have been seen in Drane, Oregon, around the 1930s, I believe.
Wow, that long ago.
Yeah.
And what did them in? I mean, what was the major source of the pressure that was forcing the numbers down for the condors?
Well, there's a lot of theories that kind of go along with that. We know that lead ammunition is a big issue for condors currently, and there's some debate as to whether or not the ammunition that existed in the late 1800s would have been sufficiently high-powered enough to cause them problems. Typically, the birds, when they do get into lead fragments from ammunition, it's because the ammunition fragments when it hits the game animal that's being shot. And that happens a lot with more modern rifles because the Projectiles are traveling at such high rates of speed that when they hit the animal, the lead mushrooms in fragments, whereas in the slower-moving ammunitions in the past, it didn't fragment quite as much, and so it may have been more difficult for animals to come across these lead fragments. But again, this is speculation. I haven't seen any good tests done with ballistics gel or anything to prove this out. I think that probably more important was the fact that from the early 1800s onward towards the late 1800s, there was a lot of effort, especially by Russian sealing vessels, to come down the coast of North America and take sea lions and seals from the coasts to kind of support the oil needs of eastern Russia at the time. And so those populations were quite heavily hunted and in some ways decimated. There were actually elephant seals along the north coast at one time. By the 1890s, the elephant seal was believed to be extinct entirely. Luckily, it wasn't, and it's making a pretty solid comeback. But harbor seals and Steller sea lions and California sea lions were equally impacted. And the evidence somewhat exists that condors relied on these marine resources, I think probably more likely in the winter times when it's harder to get inland and into the high countries where they use terrestrial game a lot more. They probably relied on these resources along the coast to keep the population supported, but they pretty much tanked in the late 1800s. We saw at that time period a drop-off in the number of turkey vultures able to winter along the north coast, and around that same time, kind of coinciding with that depletion of seals along the coast, condors also disappeared.
Is there any effect from DDT or other modern pesticides when DDT was in use that as it had the impact on other birds like the bald eagle?
It definitely did impact condors in the southern portions of the range. During the height of DDT use for crops inland, the birds down in Southern California were assessed. The eggshells were looked to see if there was thinning occurring, and that was definitely observed. Whether that happened, I would say it probably did not happen, because I don't think there was really much DDT usage going on in the Pacific Northwest at the time that the condor disappeared, and it was probably a variety of other factors.
Chris West, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange with Tiana Williams. Chris is the senior wildlife biologist directing the condor program for the Yurok Tribe. Tiana Williams is a wildlife technician and a Yurok tribal member. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about the prospect of reintroducing California condors to the North Coast. 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. When you're describing the things that that condors were eating, I get the sense they're not terribly picky eaters, Chris.
Well, as long as it's not moving around too much, they're very cautious. Just because of their great size and their long wings, taking off from the ground is not an easy thing for a condor to do. You can even, in some situations, if they're near a slope and they're on more flat terrain, you'll see them kind of go on foot and hike up the slope so that they have a little bit more of a runway to run down to take off. So that's something that also comes into their choice of food items. You can see condors go and land pretty readily at sources of food that are on steep slopes where there's going to be an easy takeoff for them, but they're a lot more hesitant to come down when it's a flatter terrain and they know that taking off is going to be more difficult. They'll sometimes sit and kind of assess the situation for up to a day to make sure that there's really not any threats around before they'll come down to something. But once they do, pretty much anything's game. They've been seen to come down to ground squirrel carcasses, deer, elk, whales. There were reports from people traveling through the Pacific Northwest in the 1800s of condors coming down when the large spawn outs of salmon happened along the river, and there was a lot of salmon carcasses. The condors could be seen along the riverbanks feeding on the salmon carcasses.
So it sounds like if they get hungry enough, they'll actually change their behavior a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. They'll still, if it's too risky, I've watched condors at carcasses that I was trying to do observations on sit in a tree above the carcass for a day or two and then take off and not come down at all. So
Wow. It
seems like they can detect slight changes in wind and temperature that will affect their ability to get off the ground that are pretty much imperceptible to us.
We have an email here from Bruce in Ashland. He says he heard on a local Medford radio talk show someone saying that the condor never existed here. Please explain the history of the condor and early Native American relationship with. First of all, the range is well established. That is true that it lived in the area, right? Chris?
It did. It extended from Baja, California, like I said, all the way up to British Columbia, mostly, from the Western perspective of the historical record. It was observed by a lot of early visitors to the Pacific Northwest. Lewis and Clark actually harvested some of the first condors that they saw, and they went into a collection. I believe one of those is still existing in the Smithsonian. Those I think were lost, but I know John Audubon had a collector that collected a very early one in I believe Oregon at the mouth of the Columbia. But Lewis and Clark did collect some. They had detailed sketches of them, and even before the arrival of Lewis and Clark to the area, some early Spanish missionaries that came through also had descriptions of them and had pretty accurate sketches of the bird. From the tribal perspective, Tiana, do you want to take that?
The condor exists from the tribal perspective pretty much with every tribe that I have talked to, not only here on the north coast of California, but throughout Oregon and, from what I understand, up in Washington as well. He exists in our stories, like I've been talking about. He is integral to our dances and our ceremonies. We've got words that predated European contact and things like that, so he existed within our society. I know the Oregonian tribes, they've got like a condor motif that they use in their basketry. Mm-hmm. So basically, condor was in and out of tribal people's lives consistently all through the history as long as we can remember.
What is the Yurok word for condor?
Preganish.
Preganish. Okay. Mm-hmm. I understand that that you mentioned something about using some of the feathers and the regalia from condor. It must have been a real chore then over the last couple of decades, more than a couple, to obtain any of those feathers for the regalia.
It's been a very serious problem. It started out with a lot of our regalia pieces being lost to us. I mean, a lot of them were collected against our will and taken into museums and things like that, where they were, in our mind, poisoned because, of course, all of these preservatives were put on them that made them so they couldn't be handled. And from the Yurok perspective, that's a very sad thing because regalia continues to live and it's supposed to be used actively so it can contribute to the ceremony. So the spirit of the parts of the creature that contributed to it can contribute to the dance as well. And we actually did manage to get some of our regalia pieces back when we restarted the dances, but initially they couldn't be used because we were afraid of that, and we had no way of getting new feathers to make new regalia. So that seriously impacted our ability to engage in our traditional activities. Since then, there has been a mechanism to get feathers that have been collected from the other sites that currently exist. And that's a great thing, and that's going to be a great thing for a lot of different tribes. But a very important and key part to the creation of regalia is engagement with the creation, including the collection of it. So while we never harmed condors, any feathers that we collected were considered to be gifts because they were a very high and sacred creature. Not having condors around flying in our skies, contributing these feathers to our regalia and our ceremonial use has been difficult. It's been a very sad thing that has impacted us in a lot of ways.
All right. Chris, I need to put you on hold to take a call on another line, and then we'll come back and put you on for response. So Chris goes on hold, and here is Jeff in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chris West and Tiana Williams. We're talking about California condors and a potential return to the North Coast.
Good morning. And first of all, I would really dearly love to see condors soaring over the skies of Southern Oregon, Northern California again. And one thing I would like to do is encourage hunters to use non-lead ammunition when they're hunting, particularly deer or elk. I've hunted with copper bullets, and it's very successfully, and they work well, and you're not ingesting lead when you eat the meat, and you're not poisoning wildlife with those bullets. And then a question, I'd like to know how fire suppression may have impacted condors, because fog suppression has allowed areas to become more brushy and more densely vegetated, where condors need a certain amount of clear ground to take off, especially after they've been feeding.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember hearing about that when I was studying wildlife biology at Humboldt University.
All right, let's get a response then. Thanks for the call, Jeff. Appreciate it. So, Chris, the first part was about the lead ammunition. California itself is dealing with this, but on a rather slow pattern, it seems like.
Yeah, this is something that the tribe has really been working hard to address over the last several years, and there's a lot of other groups that are working on this within the Condor Recovery Program. And, you know, we've been kind of working on this all together so that no one group has to reinvent the wheel. And it's been interesting because there's two main approaches, and the one is the legislative approach, which has been used by several groups, and it's in more recent times become effective. Assembly Bill 711 in California was passed last fall, which will ban the use of lead ammunition for hunting any kind of wildlife. And so, you know, that doesn't go into effect until about 2015 implementation starts, and then full implementation is going to be done around 2019. One of the reasons for delaying that is that there's kind of a large-scale ammunition shortage, as anyone that is involved in shooting sports knows, and getting non-lead ammunition is very difficult right now, and they didn't want to put anything in place that would make it difficult for hunters to be able to pursue their sport and livelihood, and so they wanted to give it a long introduction time to allow the state to work with ammunition companies to try and, you know, help them ramp up production so that that ammunition would be available at the time of implementation. The other route that's been used quite a bit, was kind of pioneered by the Peregrine Fund down in Arizona, was to try and get hunters to comply with non-lead usage on a voluntary basis. So essentially get out there and just try and outreach to the hunting community, let them know what the issues are, and assume that an informed hunting public would make a voluntary switch to non-lead ammunition because it's better for wildlife health, it's better for human health. And in a lot of cases, like the Kaibab Plateau, where they had a lot of condor poisoning happening in Arizona, they actually had up to a 90% compliance of hunters voluntarily switching over to non-lead ammunition after they were made aware of what the issues were. And that's kind of the same tack that the Yurok tribe has taken. We have been pushing for a voluntary ban on ammunition, essentially getting the word out to the hunting community and kind of helping them make that switch themselves without having to be told to make it. Now that AB 711 is going to be in place, we've kind of switched in California to more just, okay, we're not going to, you know, preach to you about why this is a problem. It has to be done now. Let us help you make this transition. We have a lot of information on the different ammunition types available. And in Oregon, where we are still doing work, our message is still the same. Okay, these are the issues that are at hand. You can solve this yourself without Oregon having to go to a legislative angle. But, you know, that's going to be up to the state and how they want to pursue it. At this point in time, we're just trying to reach out to the hunting community.
And what about the other part of Jeff's question about fire suppression and what impact that might have had on condor habitat?
Definitely, that's an interesting perspective to think about, especially considering that we don't have a whole lot of wide open spaces like there is in a lot of other areas in the more southern portions of the Condor Range. In that more heavily forested areas, I would imagine that prairies were rather important to the birds at one point in time. The edge zones provided habitat for deer. The prairies provided habitat for elk. And probably they were good foraging places, and I assume that condors tailored their foraging forays to kind of really hit key prairie areas. There's been a lot of encroachment of forest on a lot of these prairies, and so that may have an effect, although condors can soar long distances. And until condors are out there, we're not going to really know what their use of the habitat will be. The other key thing is that fires also in old-growth trees, when they do climb the trees to a certain extent, they can burn dried out or diseased branches and cause hollows. And we know that the hollows created, the tree cavities, are important for condor nesting in Big Sur. We're only really starting to get a feeling for this because the birds in Big Sur have only been breeding in using tree cavities for maybe the last 4 or 5 years, but we're really starting to see that the birds where they are available are using them about half the time over the cliffs and traditional mm-hmm. caves used by condors. And so, you know, looking at what kind of fire hollows are left in old growth trees up here will be important, but in a lot of the trees that have grown up since fire suppression started, the secondary growth trees that will eventually get to the size needed to be able to house a condor nest, without fire coming through and creating hollows and cavities, that could definitely impact their ability to use those trees as they come into the right age for nesting.
So based on the agreement signed between the Yurok Tribe, Fish and Wildlife Service, and several other agencies and groups in March, is there a timeline expressed here for when condors might actually be brought back? A lot of steps, it sounds like, just to even get to the point of making that decision.
Yeah, it's been a really long process. We've been working with the Fish and Wildlife Service for 5 years on this, and there's a lot of people have kind of looked at the discussions about the agreement and not fully understood what it is. There is no timeline in place. Really what we're trying to do here is bring the experts together and talk about what would be needed to get condors in place. And one of the things that we really pushed with the service is we really want to get condors out into the landscape, because we've been kind of assessing the habitat for about 5 years from the tribe's point of view. We've looked at contaminants, we've looked at habitat features, we've looked at changes in habitat over time, and we really feel like we're getting to a point where we have a good understanding of some of those things. But to really get a condor out on the landscape is going to be kind of a final assessment to see how the habitat really is. And the service would like to, has agreed to get on board with us and kind of have that as an assessment step.
But right, so a long road ahead, and I hope we get a chance to visit with you again. Chris West, Senior Wildlife Biologist, Tiana Williams, Wildlife Technician, working on the Condor Program for the Yurok Tribe. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.